Hello and welcome to the Second Court of Appeals afternoon session. We have one oral argument on our docket this afternoon, Jackson versus State of Texas, and we'll get started right away if you're ready. I'll ask Bonnie to call the case.
The court will now call Richard Jackson versus the State of Texas. May it please the court, Mr. J. Edward Niehaus will argue for the appellant. Mr. Matthew J. Lincoln will argue for the state.
Okay, Mr. Niehaus, are you ready?
Okay, I am, proceed. Your Honor. May it please the court.
Counsel.
Counsel. Would Your Honors like a brief recitation of the factual history?
Well, we've read the briefs and record, so I was thinking of interns and law clerks that are in here, but that might not be familiar with it.
Sure. Briefly, Your Honor, the appellant, Mr. Jackson, is self-employed as a janitor, was working overnight cleaning a building. Officer Peterson observed a single vehicle, his, in the parking lot. Stopped to investigate due to a string of burglaries in the area. Investigated the vehicle, investigated the premises, did not see any illegal activity going on. Mr. Jackson approached the officer, engaged in conversation with him, was polite, cooperative, and there was no indicia of anything that was untoward going on. As Mr. Jackson terminated the original encounter, got back in his vehicle, Officer Peterson realized that he had not obtained contact information for appellant's employer, went to approach the appellant to get contact information from the employer, smelled the odor of burnt marijuana in the appellant's vehicle. That led to a subsequent search, during which the police officer found in the trunk of the vehicle 0.08 ounces of marijuana. Appellant was subsequently charged and convicted for the offense of a Class B offense, possession of marijuana. Appellant raised five issues in his brief. I'll focus on two, on the consensual encounter versus detention issue and the jury selection issue, starting with the jury selection issue. Your Honor's excusing a prospective juror, in this case two prospective jurors, without giving defense counsel an opportunity to question those jurors, as the Court of Criminal Appeals stated in Perillo v. State, should not ever occur unless the record affirmatively and unequivocally reflects that the prospective jurors would, regardless of the evidence, not follow the law. In this case, the two jurors number 4 and 5, jurors Bumstead and Tucker, were both very equivocating during the course of voir dire, during the state's voir dire, and the record does not reflect the kind of absolute, unequivocal, I cannot and will not follow the law that was necessary for Judge Valenkamp's striking these two jurors without giving defense counsel a chance to rehabilitate them.
How were they equivocal? It seemed to me that at least one of them was firm in her no answer. Cannot follow the law.
The relevant language in the reporter's record, Judge, is reproduced in the appellant's reply brief, specifically pages 13 and 14. I don't recall if it's juror Tucker or juror Bumstead, but one states specifically, I can follow the law, and the state then follows up with, are you sure? And then she says, I don't know. And that kind of equivocation, that kind of on the fence, off the fence, I haven't really made up my mind yet, is not the kind of absolute unequivocation that you need per Perillo in the cases it cites. Specifically, one of the cases Perillo cites, Lackley v. State, was a juror that stated, Lackley was a death penalty case, I cannot, under any circumstances, even if it's a terrorist, employ the death penalty. I would contend that that's the kind of unequivocal, that absolute no. As the courts previously discussed in Williams v. State, failure to give appellant's trial counsel the opportunity to question the veneer member is reversible error.
Was there a request and a refusal?
There was, Your Honor. and the harm manifests itself in the ultimate makeup of the jury. The jury was made up, the jury that actually heard the case was made up of jurors number 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, and 15. The improper strikes were jurors number 4 and 5. Had the defense counsel been able to question and properly rehabilitate these witnesses, the state's cause strikes would have been jurors 2, 4, and 5. Defense strikes would have been 3 and 6, and juror number 1 was struck for cause. The jury that would have sat would have been jurors number 7 through 12 inclusive. The harm in this is that juror number 12, Miss Joyce, stated specifically that she believed the case was a waste of resources, and she would have been of the mindset to give a harder look at the state's evidence, give a more thorough review during the ultimate decision-making process of the case once it got as far as the jury room. In addition to the harm with jury selection, the judge also erred in his determination as to whether the encounter between Mr. Jackson and Officer Peterson was consensual in nature versus a detention. And the state in trial largely viewed this as a single continuous encounter from Mr. Jackson's approaching the officer originally through to him getting into his car and then discussing the subsequent smell of marijuana with Officer Peterson. More correct view and the view that's more in line with the testimony that was presented is that there are two separate encounters. A consensual encounter that began when Mr. Jackson originally approached Officer Peterson and terminated when he went back to his vehicle, and a second encounter that begins when Officer Peterson reapproaches the vehicle for purposes of, as he testified, just in case something was criminal and I didn't catch it. And Your Honor, there's no circumstance in which just in case it was criminal and I didn't catch it is going to withstand Fourth Amendment scrutiny. Similarly, case on point, McDougal versus State. In McDougal, the Court of Criminal Appeals held that without a traffic law violation, without running a stop sign, without driving strangely, there's got to be some kind of a basis, some kind of a reasonable, there has to be some kind of a reason for Officer Peterson to stop appellant. And
articulable facts.
Yes, Judge. Something other than just in case it was criminal and I didn't catch it. And where you've got, and I'll even go so far as to say that when he was investigating the possible burglary, he had something. He had reasonable suspicion at the time he was investigating the burglary to go ahead and approach appellant, to go ahead and see what was going on, why he was there, to verify that there was no criminal activity going on. He verified that there was no burglary. Then, after he verified there was no burglary, when he called appellant's plates in to dispatch, there was an error in dispatch where they ran an incorrect plate number. The plate did not come back matching the appellant's vehicle. The officer testified that for so long as they were investigating whether the plates properly matched the appellant's vehicle, that he was not free to leave. When they realized the dispatch ran the wrong plate, and then they ran the correct plate and it came back matching, appellant was allowed to get back into his vehicle and the original encounter was over. It was after that original consensual encounter end that the detention began. When Officer Peterson went back and stopped appellant from leaving, that's the key phrase. When he stopped the appellant from disengaging, that's a detention. And Fourth Amendment scrutiny starts to apply there. The fact that he did it for no other reason than just in case I missed something.
Well, does the record show that the car was driving away?
I don't believe he'd put the car in gear yet, but he was in the vehicle, I believe, with it turned on.
Does the record show whether the officer indicated for him to roll down his window?
I don't recall, Judge. I don't believe so. But the fact that he was in the process of trying to leave and then was stopped from leaving, that's your detention.
Well, but how do we know he was stopped from leaving? How do we know he couldn't have just put his car in reverse and drove away? I mean, what I'm saying is, what facts in this case distinguish it from a consensual encounter?
In the event that, from the appearance of the testimony and the record, it appears that had the appellant attempted to leave, he would have been stopped. And whether that was by actual force or whether that was of his own accord, the end result is the same. The end result is that after he disengaged, the officer reengaged. And the officer's reengaging is what takes this outside of the realm of a consensual encounter and brings it into Fourth Amendment territory.
Why?
Because the officer's got to have probable cause. He has to have something. He has to have something more than just in case it was criminal and I didn't catch it.
But if he just went back up there and they had a consensual discussion, whether or not he's re-engaging, to me, doesn't make any sense. I mean, it's like we're starting afresh. He's walking up there to the car, and of course, if he starts to search or something, he needs some sort of probable cause. But if he just walks up to him and there's a consensual discussion, I don't know why the fact that he's re-engaging makes any difference.
An objective person standing in the defendant's shoes would recognize that the officer's secondary approach is going to be one that requires him to stop.
Sorry, I'm just not following the logic there. The difference between he's basically told him, okay, you can leave. I guess that's what his impression was.
Yes.
Okay, you can leave. And then he walks back up. I mean, I gather we don't have anything in the record about halt, you can't leave, you don't do anything. He just walks up there and they have a discussion.
That's correct. Yeah, and in ideal circumstance, the record would be more clear on the body language that was used on whether or not the officer actually made physical contact with the vehicle in order to get appellant to roll the window down. In an ideal situation, we would have a better record.
Well, let's just say, for example, there was no previous encounter. It's just he's there and a police officer walks up to him based on the facts that we have before us, just no previous encounter. Would you say that it was a consensual encounter? And if not, what would you point to show that it was not?
Without the prior encounter, I don't believe I have ground to argue that it was not, that it was unconsensual.
Okay, well then what I'm having trouble conceptualizing is the fact that there had been a previous encounter transforms this otherwise consensual encounter into something more.
Yeah, it goes to the objective reasonableness of a person standing in the defendant's shoes. When he has that first initial encounter and then he is, as the testimony reflects, he's anxious to get it to leave. He's trying to get away. He's trying to get back to get to his next job. And when he goes and disengages, then the officer comes back and restarts the conversation. It provides that restarting of the conversation after you've made an active attempt to try to terminate it. He brings it outside of the realm of a usual consensual encounter.
Is it your position that we're limited to the testimony at the hearing on the motion to suppress because there is other evidence at the trial when the officer testifies again that is a little bit different? He testified, as I recall, that Mr. Jackson seemed anxious to leave, particularly in light of the fact that there was another officer present. Or he was walking up there and maybe even seemed anxious, nervous type anxious. And that's all I can remember at the moment, but that would indicate maybe a difference in the result that he then started walking toward the car.
Yes, I think, and I believe Your Honor is right, that his desire to terminate the encounter goes to, especially once it's re-engaged, goes to the consensual nature of the encounter. Officer Peterson's testimony was, by and large, that the appellant was cooperative, that he was open and honest, and dangerously candid with the officer with regard to both the smell of marijuana in the vehicle and other topics, but his desire to leave, the anxiousness that he expresses, is one more factor that shows that the secondary approach after he finally managed to terminate the encounter was not going to be a consensual one. Although I don't believe we are called to reach the question, as the jury selection error should be dispositive of should be dispositive in terms of whether this cause is reversed or remanded for new trial.
But even if we reversed on the voir dire issue, wouldn't we have to reach the suppression issue since it would recur at the next trial?
Yes. And our position would be that, I see that my time's expired, may I?
Yes, please.
Okay, and my position, yes, would be yes, Judge, that we would need to reach the suppression issue and that the appellant's demeanor insofar as he was nervous and showing a clear, if not expressly stated on the record or expressly stated in the video, statement, I wish to terminate the encounter, the appellant's demeanor goes to the fact that he was attempting and was desiring to terminate the encounter and that any subsequent approach by the police officer was of a nature to render it a detention as opposed to a consensual encounter. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Counsel. Mr. Whitten? Well,
may it please the court, counsel.
Counsel.
Good afternoon. The trial court did not abuse its discretion in this case in either its action of denying appellant's motion to suppress or in excluding those two jurors. With respect to the jury issue, I guess I'll start there. The record reflects that these jurors did have strong feelings about misdemeanor marijuana possession laws, as is pretty typical in those trials. And what this does for us in our analysis here is it lends credence to the trial court's decision to strike them for cause because it shows that the jurors were not equivocating as much as appellant rights. But even if they were equivocating, even if we accept that they did not clearly state that they couldn't follow the law, the dismissal of the two jurors was still proper and not reversible error. The reason is that the cases say that a discharge of a juror for cause requires reversal only if it's shown that the error deprived the appellant of a lawfully constituted jury. That has not happened in this case. There hasn't been a showing of that. We don't have another juror that ended up on the jury that shouldn't have been there. There's a very important bit of reasoning behind that rule. The reasoning is we want to prevent trial courts from committing the greater sin of not striking a juror for cause who maybe should have been, and then we do have an unlawfully constituted jury with a juror that should have been struck for cause and therefore a serious problem.
Doesn't it strike you that there should be a distinction between improperly striking a juror for cause, as you just discussed, versus giving the other side, whether it's you or defense counsel, the opportunity to examine the venire person?
Well, I guess what I'm saying, Your Honor, is that even if the judge should have given appellant the opportunity to do that, it's not reversible error. I would say that the distinction in the end analysis isn't that important because we want to prevent that greater problem of a juror who is not qualified to serve on the jury serving. That obviously is a bad thing. And so the rule is in place to prevent that from happening.
But how do we know if they're qualified or not qualified if the defense doesn't get a chance to examine them?
Well, we do know that they were talking about a juror that would have otherwise made it. The jurors, the defense, and the state both had an opportunity to ask questions of all of of all the jurors that did end up on the panel.
But once they gave their answers, the defense was not permitted to query any further.
Mm-hmm. Well, from the record, we can tell that the two that were dismissed were disqualified. They both had strong opinions against our marijuana possession laws. One of them even said, I think, that her dad uses marijuana for his medical condition therefore would have a very difficult time sitting in judgment of somebody else who she looks at him and sees her dad.
One of them, Mr. Bumstead, or Mrs. Bumstead, I wonder if it's Mrs. Dagwood Bumstead, anyway, says in one part she could follow the law, then says twice she doesn't know if she could follow the law, but that it would not violate her conscience to follow the law. So I don't possibly see how she's just unequivocally disqualified on that without an opportunity, at least the other side, to talk to her.
I don't disagree that she was equivocating. I agree with you. I think she was equivocating. There's no question. But the trial court's action, the trial court has discretion to make that decision to dismiss the juror where we're trying to avoid the problem of possibly having somebody on the jury that could have been disqualified. So the rule is in place to prevent precisely that problem. Well, with respect to the suppression issue.
Well, based on that answer, it almost sounds like to me that the juror could say the very little incriminating type statement and it would be okay to be stricken. I mean, if there was any hint that they might be stricken for cause, it's okay if the trial court strikes them without giving the other side the opportunity to talk to them. That just doesn't.
Well, I think we have enough here in this case where it was clear that Ms. Bumstead did have a problem with the law, though, enough for the judge to make that decision. But your point is well taken, for sure. I'm sorry. Go ahead. The point I'm trying to make is that it's not harmful and reversible error in this case.
You're saying that defense counsel hasn't shown that the juror that was seated meets the criteria to demonstrate harmful error.
That's exactly what I'm saying, yes.
And that criteria is that it's basically a disqualified person. Is that
right?
What you're saying?
That whoever it did end up on the jury, there has to be a showing that those two persons that ended up on the jury in lieu of Ms. Bumstead and Mr. Tucker were unqualified to serve.
Unqualified to serve.
Been
stricken for cause.
Yes. Yes. Moving on to the suppression issue. Everyone agrees that the first encounter was consensual. I don't think there's any question there. The question is whether what appellant's calling the second encounter, when the officer reapproached the car, whether that action was lawful. The appellant urges, both in his brief and his reply brief, that the officer had, an investigatory purpose when he went back to the appellant's car. Because of his words, he said, just in case something was criminal and I didn't catch it. Respectfully, that's not what the officer's entire statement was in the suppression hearing. And if you go to the volume 2 of the record, page 47, he's being asked, well, why did you go back to the car? Why was it important? And the prosecutor asked, after you had spoken to him and gone back to your car, why was it important for you to gather the information about his boss? He had testified, well, I needed his boss's contact information, the dentist that owned the building. And he said, well, what our department doesn't want is if we're going to make contact with somebody to not at least have very basic and generic information, which is contact info. You know, it is, if possible, for his boss or something like that, just in case something was criminal and I didn't catch it, we're able to have contact information. So that's why it's important in that time, in that moment. In other words...
But they had the defendant's contact information, correct?
They did. And what he was explaining was that he's going to have to go back to the station and write a report about this encounter. And he wanted to make sure that he had all the information he needed.
He knew the location of the building, correct?
Yes.
He knew the address of the building.
Yes.
And he knew the name of the dentist's office.
Yes, he did. He did. He wanted the boss's name as well. Wanted to be able to put that in report, and that was his testimony.
Well, don't you
he
see...
Did, there's no,
don't you see a distinction that between if someone has yielded to a show of police force, as the defendant did initially, there's no question that the initial investigation when the license plate came back erroneously typed in was an investigatory detention, as it could be, based on the reasonable suspicion caused by the single car parked at night by itself in front of the dentist office. Then once the police officer told the defendant that he was free to leave, isn't there a different type of analysis if he then reapproaches? It's not like some random police officer who just happens to be walking up with no prior past, but now you have someone who has specifically said you're free to leave, and now aren't they re-invoking their show of authority at the time they reapproach the car?
Not in this case, and here's why. First of all, if you look on page 136 in volume 3, we do have evidence that the appellant was not driving away, that he rolled down his window on his own when the officer approached, and he wasn't making a show of authority here. And his testimony, if we take him at his word, is that he wasn't trying to investigate more crime. He wasn't walking back up to the car to find drugs or what have you because he was just so convinced something was wrong. He was walking up to the car because in his mind he needed the appellant's boss's name for his report. And that's it.
Which he didn't put in his report.
That's true. He did not put that in his report. I don't know why. And I believe he was asked that, and he didn't have much to say.
Also, if we're going to go into the trial testimony, I'm concerned about the officer's change in his testimony from I don't know whether the defendant had started his car to in the trial, that was at the suppression hearing, to yes, he had his car was on.
Yes, I'm aware.
Motor was on in the trial.
I would only be speculating if I tried to reconcile that. If I may speculate, it's probably that the officer had sat down again to watch the video, read his report prior to trial, and just remembered. But I would only be speculating to answer that, to try and reconcile that for you.
Well, just like venue, when you don't just look at what the trial judge had to look at in the venue hearing, you look at the venue hearing and the whole trial, or do we just look at what the judge had before it at the suppression hearing and not what he additionally knew after the trial? And I think Justice Gardner asked that a minute ago, and I didn't hear an answer.
Well, I think we need to go, in this case, I'm not sure it really affects our analysis. Probably need to go on the suppression because that's what the judge had to decide.
When he ruled.
Right. However, if this court did reverse it or whatever, that wouldn't preclude it from not being suppressible later if additional evidence came out at another suppression hearing or something like that. But I think that the court is allowed to take all the evidence that is before it and known in considering whether the error was, if there was an error, was harmful or not. But of course, I think that the court's constrained to what happened at the suppression hearing when making that decision, whether the suppression
should have
been.
Well, it makes common sense.
It would make sense to me. Now, I don't have a case for you, and I know I'm arguing kind of from the hip there, but that's what would make sense to me.
So the truth is, it doesn't matter why the police officer went back to talk to him as far as anything that has nothing to do with probable cause. He could have gone back there and said, I really like that jacket you're wearing. Where did you buy it? I'd like to buy one. That has as much to do with probable cause as, oh, I forgot to get all the contact information, right?
I agree with you, save An exception.
Okay.
And the exception I would give you was if there was evidence, which there isn't in this case, that that officer was trying to investigate some specific crime that was going on at that point.
Well, I agree.
If he did have it in his head.
But that's not here.
Yeah, that's not here. There's no evidence of that here. And so what we have is a situation in which there's nothing on which to reverse. But regardless of that, there is the evidence, as I mentioned earlier, that there was not a display of authority, that there was that the appellant did roll down the window on his own, and the officer didn't say, hey, you know, you're under arrest or anything like that, or turn on his lights on his car or anything like that. So
why did the defendant roll down his window with one officer standing in the parking lot and the other one approaching, the one that testified approaching the car, and say we don't know whether he had started the car yet, but he was preparing to leave. Why would he roll down the window instead of just drive away? Unless there was a show of authority that he was yielding to.
My answer would be because he was consenting to another encounter because he saw the officer walking up to the car again.
It's his motion to suppress, but do you have to prove it's a consensual encounter?
No, I don't think so.
You just have to prove it was more.
No, it's a burden to show that the actions were unconstitutional. Now, there's no warrant here, so we have to make a prima facie showing, which I believe we did at trial. But as far as being a consensual encounter, I think at this point it's the appellant's burden to show that it wasn't. And point to evidence in the record that would show that it was not, which I'm sorry I'm out of time, but there isn't.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Niehaus, rebuttal.
Hopefully just briefly. Please the court, counsel.
Counsel.
One quick point and possibly a second. With regard to case law cited by State of Texas on the requirement that a cause strike is only reversible error if it results in an unlawfully constituted jury, State's argument does not take into account that is a case in which the cause strike was after voir dire by both sides. Controlling case law for the restriction of voir dire to state-only voir dires, Anson v. State, specifically Justice Myers from the Court of Criminal Appeals concurring opinion, where she states, once individual questioning was permitted and revealed the possibility that a veneer person would not follow the law, appellant should have been allowed to ask the veneer person whether they would be able to lay aside personal experiences and follow the law.
But does that then, okay, let's assume that's true, but does that then lead us to the conclusion that and it's harmful error if you do not?
It does, Judge. The following page of that opinion, she concludes with, quote, no voir dire error that ultimately affects the makeup of the jury could be found harmless.
That sounds completely contrary to what we were just discussing.
Could you clarify, please?
Well, we just discussed that if a person ends up on the jury in order to be reversible error, they have to be somebody that should have been disqualified.
And that
sounds completely different from what you just said there.
And the distinction is that in the case law cited by the state, that was a juror member that was voir dired by both sides. The case law that I cite is an early cause dismissal like we have here.
So in the case that you're citing, the makeup of the jury that's impacted is that person was not given the opportunity to be on the jury, the person who is excused for cause without being voir dired by both sides?
That's basically correct, yes, Judge. It goes to the basically making the state have an extra peremptory strike by not forcing them to use a peremptory strike on the improperly caused juror. And then that depending on how the other cause strikes play out, affects where the which juror number, the domino effect, right?
Yeah.
And appellant's position is that that kind of harm that is basically the Justice Myers' opinion in Anson's dispositive of at least the Fort Dyer issue. In the event that it's reversed, rest on our original argument on consensual encounter versus detention. All right, thank you, Your Honor.
All right, thank you, counsel. Thanks to both counsel. Good arguments, good briefs, excellent briefs, as a matter of fact. Your case is submitted, and you're excused. Thank you.